Reel number six. Colonel, you mentioned firing on the move. What sort of accuracy were you getting in these days when you were firing on the move?
Because accuracy wasn't very high, but it was generally pretty good in the area of the target, if not always at the target. But the policy of firing on the move, I think, paid a dividend, because when war happened, it was very rarely used, but those who had been trained to fire on the move were superb gunners from a stationary position, and most of the firing in wartime was done by coming up to a firing position, taking careful aim, firing, and then moving back out of sight. Although there were obviously occasions when people let off their weapons on the move, it was not a general practice.
What about the question of gun sights in these days? Was there much advance in your time at Lulworth on this?
There wasn't a great deal, no. The telescope was used for with a slight the telescope, I forget the exact magnification, but it had a slight magnification, and of course a crossfire, which you sighted for a moving target, you allowed aim off, and for a, if you were stationary, the target was stationary, no aim off. It was very simple, and for sighting, for preparing the gun for firing, you used the crosswires on the end of the barrel. You were told to use hair from a horse's tail and make this crossfire, because first of all you had to find your horse and then persuade it to let you have the hair. But you found some means of making a crossfire, and then look down the barrel and synchronize the telescope.
So you had to have the cavalry to help you then, really?
that's what it amounted to, yes. Yeah.
Looking back over the years, in the interwar years, did you do a great deal of showmanship in the way of tattoos and the like?
Yes, we did a lot of that. Medium tanks weren't allowed on the various tattoo arenas because of the damage to the turf by the tracks. But light tanks were, and our usual role was to come in on either the final scene or the battle scene and sweep across the arena firing our guns. And the problem with light tanks, of course, was that the commander fired the gun, and therefore nobody could see except the driver where you were going. And once or twice at the Aldershot tattoo, I found myself still firing the gun while proceeding up the road to, back to barracks. We also took part in the Tidworth tattoo, as a sort of break from manoeuvres. I don't think there was any tactical value, but it was a break, and it was interesting. You had to make sure that both the blank attachment for the machine gun and the tank itself was in good trim, and I think it was a good break for everybody.
So in effect they were fairly popular with the men, were they?
I think so, yes. They liked sort of showing off their prowess to the world in general, and they did jolly well too.
Did you get a good reception from the crowd on your events?
Well, I think it was always a very popular event, the battle scene. Yes, I think they did. They got a very good reception.
What about leadership over the time that you were in the Tank Corps, Colonel? You've mentioned one or two important people. What about Broad, for example?
And he was a tremendous power, both behind the scenes and actively. I think I mentioned before that he was instrumental in producing that document, Modern Formations 1931, which was a masterly effort for trying to see into the future, on which the activities of the Tank Brigade were largely based. And he commanded it, as far as I remember, in 1932, one, I forget now, but he did command the Tank Brigade at that for on a number of occasions. And he was always interested in the driving force behind new innovations and new ideas.
How often did you meet him?
I met him several times, of course, in the officers' mess. I met him in the field quite a bit. The first time I met him, I suppose, was on the 1932 manoeuvres. And he came round inspecting each vehicle of the 2nd Battalion. He was most meticulous in these inspections, because he turned out, he and his staff, absolutely impeccably. And I had on my tank a device for carrying extra oil on the rear, which I think he had been instrumental in pushing forward the design, which had been made by our regimental fitter. And of course, when he came near the tank, he pointed to this device and said, "What is that?" And unfortunately, I said, "A 5-gallon oil drum," which he very nearly exploded and intimated that he knew perfectly well what a 5-gallon oil drum was. What he meant was, what was the device that was holding it?
Did you find him interested as much then in the men as he was in the broader issues of development of the tank?
No, I think he was more interested in the broader issue and the future employment and the improvement mechanically of the vehicles, rather than perhaps the men as a whole, although he was very interested in them. But I never saw him meet an old friend in the tank crew.
So he was more of a man on strategy than...
Very much so.
Now, Hobart was quite different, wasn't he?
He was, in a way, yes, he was. He had his... rather apt to have his favourites. Very rightly, too, because he was a wonderful man for picking the right person for the right job. And consequently, the favourites were exceptionally good people. He was... I did have a lot to do with him, both when he commanded the 2nd Battalion and when he commanded the Tank Brigade. I can remember quite a lot of occasions where... would you like me to...
Please.
See? Yes, I think possibly the best thing that he ever did was this. He insisted on officer-to-officer wireless communication. That did ensure that communications were smooth and everybody was in the picture, and they knew something about the means of transmitting. In the tank brigade, I think one of the other things that he was so good at was instituting the orders groups, so that the giving of orders was done in the right sequence. The battalion commanders met at a certain point, and they in their turn had left orders for their company commanders to meet them at certain points, and the company commanders had left orders for the section commanders to meet them at certain points at a certain time. And everything in the giving of orders was methodical and was the basis of the future army adoption of this method of giving orders. He was excellent at that. He also instituted harbor drill. We called harboring, going when the tanks went into a rest position at night. In enclosed country, that was called harboring. In open country, you would leaguer, and that is the hard-skinned vehicles with the guns would form a protective fence for the light-skinned vehicles who were inside. It used to be called lagering, but with the tank brigade it became called leaguering. And the harbour drill was very carefully thought out, and battalion harbour masters met the brigade harbour master at a certain point, and they had to have a vehicle with a wireless set, which was usually a light tank. And they went off and reconnoitred the harbour, and then called up their battalion harbour party for laying out the battalion harbour, and then the rest of the battalion at the time when they were to go into harbour came in very smoothly. It was a very carefully thought out drill, and Brigadier Hubbard was very largely responsible for it. I think I mentioned before how insistent he was on using a quarter inch map instead of the 1 inch. Yeah. That was, of course, to prepare us for operations in a country which the mapping hadn't been very carefully done, or an area like the Western Desert of Egypt, where there were little or no roads or prominent features. And it did pay a dividend, I'm sure.
So a very meticulous man indeed, in effect.
He was, and also in all his tactical instructions and orders and training, he worked on center lines for the brigade. He laid down a center line for the brigade for movement, and the battalions were given their center lines, and the brigade moved usually by bounds on those center lines.
Was there no system before Hubbard then?
It was, but I can't remember them ever calling it center lines. It was mostly before, I think, done by bounds with areas rather than a center line. And the center line gave you more of an opportunity for selecting your own approaches, roads or in open country, the area, as long as you kept to the general center line. And also a battalion headquarters could be found on that center line, and brigade headquarters would be found on that center line, which was a very useful thing on occasion. And also, he did introduce a method of movement out of action, that is, when you are moving to an assembly point or something like that, in small packets to avoid congestion and avoid being seen by air. And that worked very well indeed, and we used to practice that a lot. We liked it very much because it meant that, your section went off entirely on its own and was not mothered by the company or the battalion. All these things he taught us and insisted on them being done, and I think it was invaluable training and also proved a basis for the army to follow in the future. He was also, I think, instrumental in the introduction of black overalls for the Royal Tank Corps. And these were produced, I suppose, somewhere in the neighborhood of 1933-34. They were very similar to the battle dress. You had the tunic and the trousers separate. And I think he was really responsible for the design of those. I do also remember one or two things about him. In 1932, when I was very young, second lieutenant, I was woken up one night about 3 in the morning by the orderly sergeant to say that the sports field was flooded at Farnborough. And bearing in mind Colonel Hubbard's insistence that you must do something, I went out with him and we took a long key with us from the guardroom and we looked for little places in the road or the field where there might be things to turn off, and we turned them off. And if it didn't have any effect, we turned them on again, at least we thought we did. And in the end, we found the right one and stopped the flood and went back to bed again. Next morning, there was a tremendous harouche at regimental headquarters, and I was summoned in to know why I'd turned off the gas in the neighboring village of Cove, and nobody in that village could have their breakfast that morning. So, I did explain to Colonel Hubbard that we had been taught to, when in doubt, do something. And he supported me absolutely, and I never heard another word about the episode. He had his funny ways too. The water polo final, and I think it was 1933, when we were playing the Royal Army Medical Corps, who were our great rivals, and we played for an hour and a half because the teams were so equally matched and we kept having extra time. And he was there cheering us on, but unfortunately in water polo it's very easy to commit an offence, such as swimming over a man or tackling him when he hasn't got the ball, and for which you are penalised by being sent to the side, sent out of the water. Unfortunately, I got sent out of the water on one occasion for impeding a swimmer. And the next morning, I got summoned and was dressed down right, left and centre for behaviour unbefitting of an officer, and it was no good explaining to him the rules of water polo. You just had to accept it, and I think he was right too. Another occasion, I think it was 1934, my section was detailed at very short notice to go up on Salisbury Lane to some area, I forget exactly where it was, where there was a tarmac road, and he, as brigadier, wanted to try out a method of mine clearing. the Royal Engineers had laid British anti-tank mines on the road. In fact, they had put them on the road, rather like pudding basins on the road. They hadn't dug them in, which of course was the way tank mines were laid in the war. And we were to approach in what we called a snake patrol. This is how we moved always in the light battalion, with the point out in front, then the reserve supporting the point tank, and then the support supporting the point tank, and the reserve behind. And I was to come up with my point tank leading, and the point tank was to swing when it saw the mines and sweep them off the road. We were asked to do this at very short notice, and I took the section up to the point where we were told to go and met Brigadier Hubbard, and he asked me who was going to do the job. And I said, well, I think it would be better if I did it, because our point tank is a man you know very well, a sergeant, who was temporarily in the job because of the sickness of the real proper sergeant. Brigadier Hubbard had perhaps passed him on to the light battalion rather than rather glad to get rid of him. He was a very nice man, this sergeant, but he had a very large family and he was really only fitted for duties, sanitary duties or duties of counting equipment or that sort of thing. A very decent sort of chap, lost his head very easily. And no, he wouldn't play. He said, you must use your point tank, you will use your proper point tank. And so I had to say yes. And we came up. The area was canalized by Dannet wire, so you couldn't very well miss it. And we came up very fast. He wanted us to come up at about 30 miles an hour. And of course the sergeant completely lost his head. And he pulled on the reins so hard that the poor driver couldn't do anything. And he came straight over the mines. No question of skidding and spritting them. And then the reins must have been released because he suddenly pulled the steering clutch and shot through the Dannet wire straight at the VIP party standing, watching, who had to scatter very very quickly. It was an absolute disaster, this thing. But he didn't blame me for it. He gave me a dressing down, naturally. But he didn't blame me for it because he had insisted on this man doing the job. We did the job with he wouldn't let me do it. We did it with the reserve tank. And in fact, it worked quite well, his idea, but it wouldn't have been any good because the mines weren't laid like that in real fact.
He was a fairly tough man, wasn't he, from the discipline point of view, by the sounds of it?
Yes, he was a very fair man. He insisted on a very high standard in everything. And if you didn't reach that standard, you either went or had a very unhappy existence. He demanded these high standards in both sport and in ordinary regimental work, and it worked. His battalion was the finest sporting battalion in the Aldershot Command, and also its turnout was notorious. I better not say notorious, but its turnout was absolutely excellent, and also in operations, on maneuvers, it was second to none. So he did exert a tremendous influence. How he did it is very hard to say, but he did insist on the very best for his staff, the people who he commanded through. And he did get the loyalty of everybody, because they knew perfectly well that what he said was right.
Yet his command has sometimes been called by some people, I believe, that sort of reign of terror.
Well, that was, yes, that was the case, because you had to be on your toes. There was very little letter, but I think it was a term which was used affectionately rather than disparagingly.